reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome on this latest edition of In the Gravel Trap. I am your host, Joey Barnes of Tribute Racing. Joined with me, as always, Adam Tate, also of Tribute Racing. And on the show tonight, we've got Frank Santoroski of Drafting Circuits, Christopher DeHardy, Motorsport.com, and Josh Farmer. And, you know, we got a hell of a show in store for you tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about this crazy F1 weekend in Bahrain. Also, IndyCar visited Long Beach, and Scott Dixon finally got to the top step of the podium, as well as what was a crazy wet weekend in Bristol. But first and foremost, we want to send our thoughts and prayers to Steve Burns and his family. His son and his wife. We, for sure, under the unfortunate circumstances that happened, we're going to miss Steve and seeing him. I'm growing up and watching him through the years on the NASCAR tour and then seeing what he did along pit road and everything. It was just a joy to watch him. And I'm pretty sure I speak for everybody here when I say that it's going to be not quite the same without him. Also, it was brought to my attention earlier today, and I can't believe I, of all people, got this, being a huge Greg Moore fan growing up, but Greg Moore would be turning 40 years old today. And for those of you that don't know, Greg Moore was an up-and-coming superstar in kart, and ironically, signed a deal with Team Penske, and things turned tragic at California Auto Club Speedway now, but Fontana Speedway then, back in 1999, where Greg tragically lost his life. But he'd be turning 40 years old, and I have no doubt that if he was around today, that a lot of the people who have won recently, Scott Dixon and your Elio Castroneves, they would have a lot of wins taken away from them with the talent level that Greg Moore was. So first and foremost, thinking about them, and want to welcome you all to the show. Guys, how are you all doing tonight?
Wonderful.
Yeah, can't complain. Doing
well myself, Joey.
I guess just briefly to start to kick off the show, Chris, I know you had a great idea and talk a little bit about Greg Moore. Each one of us had a chance to watch him growing up. A lot of us, I know Frank, you've got a little bit more time on it, but and I'd love to start with you on this, given the fact that you probably have a few more memories than we do on this one. Your favorite Greg Moore memory?
Oh, God, you know, I've got a couple, one was seeing him win a couple of Indy Lights races with his folks' team, which led him to be signed by Players. And Players' top guy at the time in Lights was Claude Bourbonnais. And then suddenly, like, Bourbonnais kind of disappeared into the backdrop and Moore dominated the series. And Bourbonnais was a guy that I knew because he raced against a buddy of mine in a Formula 5000 series up in Canada. So Bourbonnais was a familiar name to me. And this Greg Moore kid, you know, little skinny wire-rim glasses kid, didn't look like your typical race car driver at all. Came out of his hockey playing Canadian family and just came in and destroyed the series that year. And then the next one was, you know, when he won at Milwaukee, his first win, fantastic win. First of all, I believe, I want to say he's got six career wins.
Five.
If I'm mistaken, without looking it up. But the first win in Milwaukee was it? Five? Okay. First win in Milwaukee was a fantastic win. And I just remember being so elated. Oddly enough, my ex-wife, who I'm no longer married to, was the biggest Greg Moore fan you can imagine. So we watched Greg with quite interest. And, one of my side hobbies also was I do some artwork. You know, I have a degree in fine art, and I made a nice nice picture of Greg Moore in color. And I took that to Nazareth Speedway with me, was able to run into Greg and have him sign that, gave that to my old ex-wife. Shoot, I wish I had that now. and then the last one is Halloween Day, 1999. I was having like the best day ever. I was living in Pennsylvania at the time. I went to Philadelphia to see NFL football game. Big Giants fan. The Giants were playing the Eagles. And the Giants won the game in overtime. And this is a season neither the Giants nor the Eagles were really good, but it was on Halloween Day. It was fun. I had a planned later for the evening to go to a Halloween costume party with a bunch of coworkers of mine. I actually dressed as Darth Maul from the the Star Wars movie there that came out in 99. In between the football game and the party, I tried to squeeze in watching the IndyCar race. I VHS taped it, put it on, the crash was early in the race, and it was bad. And I knew it was bad because they didn't show a replay of it. And I knew at that point that this wasn't good. And even though the announcers did mention it, the flags went to half staff, and I just felt sick to my stomach and turned the race off. And to this day, I've never watched the end of the race. You know, I do understand that Adrian Fernandez won that race, but to this day, I've still got that VHS tape sitting somewhere, but I can't watch the end of that race because I was so sickened by this young guy taken from us so early in life, and he was so vibrant and so well liked amongst his competitors. So those are my Greg Moore memories. And as I look at the top of the IndyCar rankings right now, your top three guys right there, they're all close to 40 or 40 years old. You know, Montoya, Castroneves, Ganon. I think Greg would be right up there with them. So, yeah, I miss that dude a ton.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
As for me, my favorite Greg Moore memory, Milwaukee 1996, they had the camera facing turn number 4 on the main straightaway, and you saw this blue and white player's car just absolutely go crazy sideways coming off of 4, and he saved it. You know, this is his rookie year, mind you. And that, for me, the way he was able to save that car has just always been ingrained in my mind to this day. Joey, Adam, Josh?
I'll jump in there. My favorite Greg Moore memory is from 1998. It was the race in Brazil, in Rio, actually. Greg was 7th on the grid. You know, you don't expect a whole lot out of 7th on the grid. But there was a late race caution. He worked his way all the way up to 2nd. And he's hounding Zanardi. And if you think 1998, Zanardi could do no wrong. That guy was at the peak of his career. He was almost unstoppable. And with 13 laps to go, Moore does this crazy move on the outside, somehow gets it done, beats Zanardi for the win by like 4/10 of a second. So as soon as I saw that race, you know, I kind of stood up and I thought, this guy's got it. This guy is going to be amazing. It was only his 4th career win. Sadly, there weren't that many more afterwards. But that's my favorite Greg Moore memory. Josh?
Yeah, well, kind of ironic, if you will, of me, you know, not really.
I think we lost Josh there. I can tell you that as far as we keep talking about Greg Moore memories, and I'll kind of fill in here until we can get Josh back, but my favorite Greg Moore memory was going back to the 1998 season as well. Adam talked a little bit about Rio de Janeiro. I look at what happened to Michigan, and I believe it was the US 500 was the name of that race, and he was trailing Zanardi and he was trailing Jimmy Vassar, both target Chip Ganassi guys, both just phenomenal at the top of their game. And, you know, Vassar won the championship in 96. Zanardi won it in 97. Zanardi would end up winning it again in 98. But Greg Moore went toe-to-toe with them on a smaller team and just absolutely ended up blazing them both on the last lap to win that U.S. 500. And, I mean, that's always been etched in my mind. I've always loved the race at Michigan. It was always fun to watch. I really wish they would go back to Michigan. But, you know, engraved in my mind was that. And watching him up north whenever they had the races in Canada, I mean, you could tell that, you know, that was where he was from and he wanted to win up there, especially when you get up there around Vancouver and just how much of a badass he was up there. It was a lot of fun to watch, and those are the things that I'm going to take with me remembering Greg today. And that being said, I know, Josh, you kind of cut out there for a second. What's going on, man?
Yeah, sorry about that. I think it was my phone, but whatever. Yeah, I mean, you kind of took the words out of my mouth of winning, of more winning that 98 U.S. 500. I mean, it was the first race with the Hanford device, so everyone was still learning it. But I mean, you know, it's just you know Vassar and Zanardi were the two best guys in IndyCar that year, and it's just you know and Moore was just there, you know, Moore was there just buying this time the whole race, and you know, and mind you, I think he had a broken clutch, so, and he stalled it on pit road a few times, and it was just, you know, come the white flag, he just let the cat out of the bag, and the two target guys, and didn't know what hit him. So, you know, and it's just, you know, as we've all said, you know, Moore was just, you know, this amazing personality, and, you know, taken from us all too soon, and had he not have died at Auto Club Speedway, you know, I think the course of IndyCar racing would have definitely been different.
Absolutely. You know, staying along these lines, moving over to the IndyCar side and getting the night started a little bit, we had a – I know, Frank, you loved the race in Long Beach. I know you had, the article I read up that you ended up doing a write-up on, I mean, it was solid, and you love Long Beach. Personally, for me, anytime Scott Dixon wins, as much as I respect the hell out of the guy, I don't know if there's ever really an exciting race that Scott Dixon wins. That said, it was nice to see him finally break through and get that first win at Long Beach, because it is one of the crown jewel races on the IndyCar calendar. It was fun to see the excitement, the joy, you know, and I hardly ever see emotion out of Scott, and I actually saw it in Victory Lane whenever he pulled up there. And then, you know, behind him you had Elio Castroneves. Juan Pablo Montoya ended up fighting off Simon Pagenaud and essentially a train of others on the last lap. What became just those two battling became like five. And the struggles for Honda continue. Marco Andretti was the highest Honda power plant driver, Honda Aero Kit driver with Andretti Autosport, finishing up eighth. So that means Chevy dominated this race once again, holding 1 through 7 on the grid at the end of the race. Frank, I'll get your thoughts from this weekend, and then I'll also add to that, Scott Dixon has racked up a tremendous amount of wins. I believe he's 34 years old or so. He's really starting to hit what most drivers hit in their mid-30s as the prime of their career. When this is all said and done, where do you see Scott Dixon potentially being? Do you think he's got a shot to break A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti at the top of the list?
I think if anybody has a shot, it's Dixon. Honestly, I think, you know, the scary thing is I think Dixon's best years are still ahead of him. You know, you think of Dixon as one of the older guys in the sport, but, I mean, remember, he won his first open-wheel professional race in Nazareth in 2000, and he wasn't old enough to sip the champagne. So he's got tons of experience. He was racing saloon cars in New Zealand at the age of 12 or 13, and had to put a box under his butt so he could see over his steering wheel. This guy has been racing as long as since he's a little kid. And I've got nothing but respect for Scott Dixon. I agree. Yeah, there's never an exciting Scott Dixon win. Yeah, because he's just there. He's he reminds me of Alan Prost a little bit. That little bit of the professor in him. But Scott Dixon, yeah, I've watched him for years, but I first started really watching him really hard on a day. It was about 2007 or so. I had covered the IndyCar race at Kentucky, and I studied all this, stuff of programs and press stuff in the back of the car. And I took my daughter, who was 5 years old at the time, drove her to school on Monday morning after the race, and she started rifling through all my stuff there. And she said, "Oh, Daddy, who's this guy?" I'm like, "Oh, that's Scott Dixon." She said, "Oh, my God, he's my favorite race car driver." And she called him Scotty Diskin. And I still call him Scotty Diskin to this day. But that's when I just, for no particular reason, my young daughter decided that Scott Dixon was her favorite race car driver. So I really started to follow him, and I've got a ton of respect for him. And the guy can win anywhere. He's struggled with street and road courses over the years, but, he was flawless at Long Beach. He took the opportunity when Castroneves had the hesitation on pit road, made a blazing outlap, and then just took home the day. And I still think back to last year when he started dead last in Mid-Ohio, played the pit strategy right, and again drove like the professor and took that race home. So, and when you factor in the fact that Dario Franchitti won 3 championships over the age of 35, Scott Dixon will turn 35 this year. So I think the guy is dangerous. But my bigger takeaway from Long Beach was how flipping good Montoya is. Oh, my God, he was so impressive holding off Pagano. I couldn't believe how this guy can just keep you guessing, change his line every lap, and not lose a second of speed. So, earlier in the season, I wanted to call this one to be a fight between Pagano and Power. Now I'm wondering if we should call this a fight between Montoya and Dixon. So that's my takeaway from Long Beach. I enjoyed the race a ton. It was light on passing, but it was thrilling on good, hard, fun, clean racing.
Absolutely. And I think for me, some of the takeaways I looked at, I was kind of shocked that there was only one caution for the entire race. And, I looked at guys who were further back in the running order, like Mark Andretti, that hit the red that he could have put on there. And if everything came to fruition and the cautions kind of played it, would have seen a hundred rounds and finished a lot higher. So, it's one of those situations. I don't know what the deal is with Honda or what they're going to do, but along with the lack of cautions that traditionally we see at Long Beach, the other takeaway for me was Connor Daly. I mean, this kid had no practice time. And, I take that back. He had morning warm-up, and I believe he was in the car for qualifying. I'm not 100% sure. I know, Josh, I'm about to pass it over to you, and you can fill us in on that one. But this kid goes in a Dale Coyne racing machine, and it's nothing spectacular to a lot of people. I mean, P17 isn't spectacular. When you've got a race that goes solid green, after the caution, there was only one caution the entire race, as we touched on. You've got, I believe it was Luca Felipe on the first round of pit stops, stalled it, and essentially if you were 12th on back, you got screwed. I mean, Will Power just couldn't recover after that, and he stalled the car himself. But Connor Daly finished 17th. And why I'm putting this in perspective and why I'm so high on Connor is because I think I said it a few weeks on the show that Dale Coyne should do something with his head and put it on his shoulders, because there's no reason that Francisco Dracone should be in that car. Unfortunately, it's Huertas that's out. Dracone's still in. For the life of me, I don't understand that. But Daly outruns a Chip Ganassi racing machine powered by Sage Karam. Sage Karam, a guy that I know, Frank, you're pretty high on. I know a lot of guys are really high on this kid. He blazed the trail in Indy Lights and lit it up a few years ago. I personally think the kid's a bust. And I'll, that'll probably piss off a lot of people, but whatever. And at the end of the day, I see more talent out of Connor Daly than I see out of a lot of these young up-and-coming guys. And, you know, I hope that we get a chance to see Connor Daly in a ride very soon. Hopefully, I think a place like A.J. Foyt would be the perfect fit for a guy like him. It would be fun to see them expand to three cars, or if he could team up with Jack Hawksworth somehow. That right there would be one of my favorite lineups. That just seems
cool. Well, speaking of three cars with Foyt, Alex, there actually was an announcement very recently. Alex Tagliani will be driving a Foyt car at the Indy 500 this year. So Foyt's team will be going to a third car this year.
Yeah. Josh, I know you were down there in Long Beach, and you had a chance to kind of be in on the action. What all do you think of this weekend and everything that kind of transpired?
Well, as far as Connor Daly goes, I think it goes to show you, you know, I think he kind of, in a way, was like Roberto Moreno in the late days of CART, you know, just to show up the track with his helmet and his fire suit and hope for the best. And I was actually at the Honda hospitality tent when Connor was there. He was spreading cream cheese on a bagel, and Dale Coyne called him up and said, "Hey man, get your fire suit ready. Rock can't drive." So, you know, and Connor took off like a bat, and I talked to Connor before the race, and he was really calm, cool, and collected. Honestly, I guess a good word to describe Connor would be he's 13 going on 30. You know, I mean, he didn't sound like, you know, he was very realistic about, you know, he was like, you know, I just want to try and get the experience I can behind the wheel, and he just want to bring the car home in one piece. And, you know, I think they were attempting to try and go off strategy, but with only one yellow, it didn't really work out that way. But, you know, I mean, Connor did what he could do with, you know, with what he had. I mean, obviously, you know, a Dale Coyne car can only do so much. And then plus having, you know, not to keep beating a dead horse, but having Dracone as a teammate's not exactly uplifting either. I mean, if he had someone like Wilson, he'd probably be in a better spot. But anyways. But yeah, and I was also impressed with Sebastian Saavedra and his first run with Chip Ganassi Racing. I mean, being in this business, you know, the last couple of years, not much surprises me. But my jaw hit the floor when I got the release saying that Saavedra was going to be in that car. And I was like, what? And I was like, well, you know, I mean, him and Gary Peterson are still together with the money from the AFS, and, you know, Long Beach is their home race, but Saavedra honestly didn't put a wheel wrong the whole weekend. I mean, he qualified solid and he raced solid, and, you know, and it wasn't the same Saavedra that we saw last year, you know, where you see that Saavedra's got the, you know, I've seen him to have the cataclysmic brain fade, you know, but just in this one race, I mean, Saavedra seemed to be a lot more level headed, and, you know, I mean, he's going to be in a fifth car for Ganassi at the Indy 500, and he's going to run the season finale at Sonoma. So I mean, we'll see how that goes. It did make stage Karam look bad of how Karam, you know, struggled mightily. And, I mean, I'm not really counting Nola, because Nola was a whitewash for everybody. But yeah, I mean, we're really impressed with Saavedra, and I think Frank, you know, Frank pretty much spoke the truth on Scott Dixon, that, you know, Dixon is rare in the fact that he has always been, you know, he has always won, you know, he's won from the get-go. And if you look historically, a lot of drivers, you know, Johnny Rutherford, Bobby, Uncle Bobby, Allinger Sr., Ray Hall, even, that lots of drivers don't peak until they're in their 30s, where Dixon has only had, he's only had one year where he hasn't won a race, and that was 04 when the Toyota IRL engines weren't up to par, you know. So, I mean, I think the best isn't yet to come of Dixon. I mean, Dixon is kind of the silent assassin, per se. You know, he just waits for an opportunity, and then when he sees one, he takes it. And, you know, and Mike Hull's probably the smartest guy in the entire paddock. So I think, you know, the best is yet to come of Dixon, and boy, won't it be fine.
I I'll side with you on the Sebastian Saavedra. I was very hard on him last season, and I got to give him his due, and it was nice to see a solid finish for him, and honestly, one of the best drives of his career, in my opinion. You know, whether no matter where he started or what have you, the fact that he brought it home in a solid top 10, first go, that's his first outing with the team, you know, crew chief, engineer, etc. So that was good to see. On the reason why Rocky Morin Jr. was in the car was because essentially there were some financial issues between Carlos Huertas and Dale
yep.
Coyne. And then we've got a broken thumb for Morin, which, you know, that was interesting in its own right because it's just one thing, one bad thing after another. And next thing you know, Connor Daly's in the car. Word just got out that Rodolfo Gonzalez is going to be racing at Barber this upcoming weekend. Should we expect him in that seat potentially for many races to come, or are they going to get this thing shored up with Huertas?
Well, I talked to Dale on race morning on Sunday, and Dale just said, you know, it was the business issues on Huerta's part, and but he said that they're still looking to finalize the driver lineups for the Indy 500 and beyond. He told me I don't see Francesco being in the car for the Indy 500, and if Huerta's money is dried up. You know, I don't see that happening either. But plus, I've kind of got the concern with Huertas on the ovals. I mean, I remember Brian Carocchio from Air One, who does the show with us sometimes. He told me that he saw Huertas get out of the car at Pocono, and he looked like, he looked visibly scared, like what the hell am I doing out here? And he was, he got really busy at Iowa, so I mean I don't know if maybe that had to play in that, but you know, I think I think Coyne's still finalizing the lineup, but I do know that James Davison is actually close to signing a deal for the Indy 500, and we don't know nothing's been made official yet, but feel free to make a safe bet that James Davison will race for Coyne at the Indy 500.
I'll jump in and give my Long Beach thoughts now. I love the comparison, Frank, that you made to Scott Dixon being the Alan Prost of modern-day IndyCar, which he really is. And, Josh, you harken back to how he's had a win every season. He's competed at set 404 with Toyota. But those really thirsty Toyota engines, if you ask Scott, he'll tell you that's what taught him how to save fuel and how to be a patient driver. So I think that may have gone a long way into shaping the driver that is. And I also think Dario Franchitti had a great influence on Scott. He's a little bit older, was a little bit more successful. And now that Scott is the top guy at Ganassi, I think, yeah, we can see many, many more years, many more wins, many more championships. And Montoya. I am so impressed with Montoya. It's no secret that I'm a huge fan of him. But he is on fire. I think he will be a championship contender throughout the season. I think he'll be a contender for race wins every single weekend. It doesn't really matter now. Last year he was stronger on the ovals, but his performances so far have been fantastic. I do want to point out one thing. Everybody's talked a lot about the subs and everything and the rotating door that is Dale Coyne Racing right now. But looking at Honda versus Chevy, I noticed an interesting and ominous point for Honda. Of all the 23 drivers in the race, the fastest 12 laps were all Chevy drivers. That was 1 through 12. 13 through 23 was Honda. So every Chevy driver was literally faster than every Honda driver. And if we do go just a second, I want to get y'all's thoughts on that. Is Honda going to catch back up, or are they just going to be perennially behind?
Well, I don't know at this point. I want to see what the oval kits look like, but it's obvious. One of the telling things, and I was reading, I think I read the same article you did, which was from Marshall Pruitt. When Marshall Pruitt writes an article, he writes War and Peace. But Yeah. He mentioned in there that all the Honda drivers were watching the video of Castro Neves in car as he set the fastest lap, or as he set the pole winning lap, and they were just amazed at how calm the car was, how smooth the car was, and the Honda drivers said it was like fighting a beast. You know, the arms are getting jerked all over. So I think Chevy's on to something with their front wing package for the road courses. So I'd love to see what the oval tracks have to offer. And again, IndyCar has been open to changes for the aero kits throughout the season. They've not shut the door on that. So, but I believe Honda's got a little work to do. And if you look at the numbers, Hinchcliffe won in a Honda. Odd circumstances there. But Long Beach with lots of green, yeah, the quickest Honda was last, first Honda was eighth place. So.
Go ahead, Chris.
So for me with Long Beach, my only thought was that Power royally screwed himself with that first pit stop shenanigans, trying to, like, not going into the pits until, like, the very last second and having to come to a stop, which ultimately stalled his engine. That was just so bad for him. It screwed his race, and it's going to definitely put a big damper on his championship hopes, but we'll see how it affects his championship chase later on.
I had a chance to, going back to the question with the aero kits and Honda and whatnot, I had a chance to sit in on the Ryan Hunter Ray conference call today, and I asked him essentially this. You know, Ganassi and Penske were strong at the tail end of last season. They were strong in testing, and they were strong at the early part of this season. And I asked him, I said, knowing that they have the Chevy aero kit, the Chevy power plant, you know, is it maybe a lack of resources at Andretti Autosport that's keeping them from being the elite team that they once were, the dominant team that we saw for quite a few years? Or is it the aero kit, is it the power plant, or is it a combination of factors? And this is exactly, quote for quote, what Ryan Hunter-Reay had to say about this. He says, quote, "I think no, it doesn't have to do with the resources of Andretti Autosport. It really is the fact that Honda tweaked the aero kit very late in the process in reaction to some of IndyCar's rules changes. Chevrolet did it sooner, Honda did it later, I think. And by the time we had the completed package, we actually really never developed it on track, where Chevy had been testing on track long before we had our completed and homologated package together. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing now," end quote. And when I hear RHR talk about that, all I can think of is the fact that Honda was really behind the eight ball from the start because they didn't do enough with the R&D to be able to put something together on track. And he touched on it a little bit earlier and a little bit later in the conference call, because that was definitely the topic of discussion throughout the entire call, is the aero kits. And he had referenced, you know, hey, we don't have drag or downforce numbers from Chevy for the road courses. And who's to say that we don't have a better downforce package when we get to the ovals? You know, obviously the big problem here is that they don't run nearly as many ovals as they do street and road courses. And for as much as NOLA is a road course in its own right, we finally get to a place that has elevation change, and that last year was a very strong track for Honda with Marco and him finishing 1-2 with RHR taking the victory. So it'll be very interesting to see what's going on this upcoming weekend at Barber. They're predicting rain for qualifying, and then obviously it's supposed to clear up on Sunday for race day. So we'll see how that turns out. And overall, I'm pretty excited to see what Honda can finally bring to the table with either updates or whether or not we have to wait to Indy for the 500 to see if they actually have something for Chevy. So we had, moving on to the next round, the next segment, on to the next one, as they say. Adam, we had an awesome F1 weekend. And, I mean, Bahrain was just absolutely one of the most thrilling races of the season. For as boring as Australia was and as boring as China was, Malaysia was exciting, and it seems to be every other race we're getting a barn burner.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Lewis Hamilton did take the win again, but it wasn't without what could have been one more lap, and that race right there would have belonged to Kimi Raikkonen, who on a different pit strategy ended up running just incredible laps at the end, and essentially the last 20, I think it was with 23 laps to go, was outrunning Mercedes by, at one point, as much as 2 seconds per lap because he was on the super softs due to his strategy in the cooler track temperatures. It was a brilliant pit strategy on their part and almost came away with it. So to lead it on to you, I'll ask, you know, what do we take away from Bahrain? And we've also got this amazing duel happening between Ferrari and Mercedes. Should we expect guys like Kimi Raikkonen and Sebastian Vettel to be there all season?
I think we can expect them to be there all season at this point. The main thing I take away from Bahrain is it wasn't under an extreme circumstance like the heat in Malaysia that allowed Vettel to do so well, whereas Mercedes comparatively wasn't as dominant. You go back to qualifying, Hamilton took pole, yes, but just a few tenths behind was Vettel for second. He beat Rosberg in qualifying. You go to the race, Kimi beat Nico for second in the race. And arguably, it was helped a little bit by Mercedes having brake issues. The brake issues they were having made it really easy for Raikkonen to pick off Rosberg there towards the very end of the final lap. But it is worth noting the amazing lap times they put in, how they put Seb on a different strategy from Kimi, and Mercedes had to guard against it. And really, you're right. I mean, another lap, Kimi would have had him easily. And someone I was talking to the other day, I can't remember who, said, you know, if there had just been a caution, a late race caution, and Kimi would have jumped him and disappeared off into the sunset with a victory, which would be his first win for Ferrari since the 2009 Belgian Grand Prix and his first win since Australia in 2013. So I do think the time is coming. I think he will win this year. I think Vettel will win more. I don't know if they can fully stay ahead of Mercedes or even quite get on par, but these alternate strategies and these opportunistic moves keep working out for them, and I love it because if you look back, it's a pretty big gap to Williams, sadly, but a bright spot for them. Bottas came in a strong fourth, and Massa, starting from the pit lane, charged all the way up to 10th. So they have a little bit of development work to do. If they could join the fight, if anyone else can join the fight, it would be awesome. But at the meantime, it's very much Ferrari versus Mercedes.
And I think one thing to make note of is Fernando Alonso in a McLaren Honda, really underpowered team, under-resourced team at the moment, just because of the amount of lack of resources that they have, ended up bringing it home in 11th and almost finished in the points. I will say a wry smile crossed my face when I saw Kimi Raikkonen passing him and lapping him before that final pit stop. I won't deny that, given the shenanigans at Ferrari last year. But, you know, what do you make of this pit strategy that they did with Kimi Raikkonen? I mean, it was just absolutely, in my mind, it was absolutely brilliant with the fact that, you know, you've got hotter temperatures, medium tires are going to last longer, they're not going to burn off faster, and the sun was, not the sun, but, well, actually, yeah, at the time, the sun was still a little out, and track temperatures were a lot higher, because as we know, you're in the desert, the track cools off tremendously. You know, what do we make of this strategy? And I'm kind of shocked that we didn't see more of it, and along those lines, they did a brilliant call, so that way Ferrari didn't have to battle each other, because at the early part of the going, Kimi had caught Vettel, and had radioed in and said how much he was faster, but he would try to overtake. And they didn't let that happen, so there wasn't quite that conflict of interest that we now see at Mercedes, to where they pretty much run into each other anytime they're battling for the lead.
Yeah, and it's interesting because if you go back to that, and that those early laps, when Kimi was held up by Vettel a little bit, but only won the race by a little over 3 seconds. So Ferrari did really well, but they kind of scored an own goal by not telling Seb to get out of the way. I think the tire strategy was really smart. Be on softs for the end. They're the quickest tire. You have a lighter fuel load. You're going to put in the quicker laps. The really long stint on mediums worked out because Kimi led for quite a few laps. And, you know, they put him back on softs on lap 40. and everyone knew it was on. He was hunting down Nico, and then when he got Nico, he was hunting down Lewis. So everyone likes to say one more lap, but this is a really genuine case of it would have been one more lap. I think we didn't see that strategy from anyone else because everyone else was just so far behind. I mean, Bottas had a good race. Ricardo had a good race, even though his engine let go. And he coasted across the finish line, which he is now on. Is it his fourth or his fifth engine we were talking about yesterday?
I believe it's his fourth, yeah.
Yeah, so he's already on his fourth engine, which, if you read the regulations, the FIA wants you to have four engines for an entire season. And we just had Bahrain. So Red Bull is in serious trouble with Renault. I really don't know how they got into this mess. So I'm really curious to see how they dig out of it. But another good performer, once again, was Romain Grosjean for Lotus. And Lotus has kind of passed up Sauber now for that fourth spot. So they're trying to hunt down Williams while Williams is trying to hunt down Ferrari. And Ferrari, you know, it's so early in the season, I think they might be able to catch Mercedes and pull it off. I hope they do, just for the sake of more entertaining racing, and that we can break this cycle of boring race, exciting race, boring race, exciting race. So really, really hoping we can have exciting race, exciting race, exciting race. So that's what I'm looking for in F1.
Frank, what was your take from this weekend? I mean, it was just a phenomenal F1 weekend, but what was your take from Bahrain?
So it was a great weekend. You know, again, here's Lewis Hamilton throwing down, but the biggest thing was to see Nico get passed twice and then grab that position back. My buddy Steve Abel, who covers Formula 1 at Drafting a Circus, we often talk about Nico Rosberg and is he just freaking thoroughly deflated with Hamilton beating him every week. And I saw some good fight out of Nico this week. And the other thing that just blows my mind is Red Bull's about out of engines. This is a team that's won the championship how many times in a row, right? How many Vettel? Six championships with Vettel?
Four,
right? Well, four, six, 20.
Seriously, yeah.
But Renault was another great name in Formula One. Go back to the 70s when Renault essentially started the turbo era. And I can't believe they're having such engine issues like this, when we have the regulations in place. So they're talking grid penalties for the next race. So essentially they're starting, with a handicap before they begin the race. But, I don't think anybody's going to touch Hamilton for the championship. I think he's going to pull down his third championship easily. I want to see Ferrari take the fight to them when we get to the European swing, which is coming up, and that's all the stuff right in Ferrari's wheelhouse. You know, we've got Monza coming up, British Grand Prix coming up, no German Grand Prix, from what I understand, but that's the heart and lifeblood of Formula One that I grew up watching was that European swing. I don't mind the Far East races, but gosh, I love to see a Formula One on the classic tracks, and I hope Monza stays on there for years and years to come, although my understanding is that might not be the case. But if Ferrari were to win at Monza with Vettel, that would be freaking incredible. Formula One is, I don't want to say it's back, but it was a pretty good race this weekend, even though the same guy won.
Yeah, I'm not ready to say it's back either, but it is, like you were just saying, going back to Europe now. We got Spain, we got Monaco, we've got Germany, sadly, but we still have Belgium, we still have Silverstone, Monza. You know, Ecclestone has made threats, but I don't think they will ever take Monza off the calendar. And if Vettel were to win, that would be fantastic. The first few flyaway races are always interesting, but to me it doesn't really get that exciting until they come back to Europe. All the teams are based in Europe. All the major first rounds of updates are going to come in Europe. And like you, I grew up watching these classic European circuits. I grew up on IndyCar, and when I discovered Formula One,
it was this exotic, amazing thing that was even faster, that raced these places I couldn't even pronounce yet. And that's what I think really draws in a lot of the fans. So I'm looking forward to it, and I think Ferrari's going to do it. I wish them luck. Joey?
I got high hopes. I mean, if Ferrari is doing well, Formula One is doing well.
Exactly.
That's, look in the history books, you know? So.
You know, from my standpoint, I want to touch on a couple of things just before we move on to the next segment, the final segment. And that's, you know, Christian Horner talks about essentially this engine. He's paraphrasing here. essentially, he said that he expects this motor to become a coffee table, you know. And all I can think of is, you know, the Top Gear set. I mean, how much I would love to have that in my house. But, you know, it's sad. And if it continues to go that route, I really don't think Renault's going to be in the sport much longer, which is very sad because they did such a great job developing and really putting their stamp in the sport. And whether it's, you know, this move to this V6, you know, and not being able to play catch up and learning the brand new systems or what have you, for the life of me, I couldn't tell you. But it would be a shame to see them go. I believe Red Bull is the last team that it has a Renault engine. I think everybody else, I mean, Mercedes has switched over, Lotus has switched over to Mercedes and what have you. So that would be a real shame. But to Frank's point, I don't believe that Lewis Hamilton is going to run off into the sunset. I do believe that you're going to find your Sebastian Vettel or your Kimi Raikkonen, bring the fight to them because, you know, Lewis Hamilton, for as near unbeatable as he seems, that kid does have chinks in his armor, and he is very beatable, especially when his confidence isn't quite where it needs to be. And I think when you look at guys like Kimi Raikkonen and Sebastian Vettel, I mean, there is not a better driver that you can say, or better pair of drivers that you could say has ice water running through their veins than those two. So, you know, I mean, he's called the Iceman for a reason, and I'll tell you right now, and I'll call it well in advance, so that way somebody can't call me out later. Kimi Raikkonen is going to win in Belgium. He is going to win Spa. I mean, that guy just has it figured out there. That car is perfect for a track like Monza, for a track like Spa. The place I wonder about is one of the crown jewel races on the calendar, and is Monaco. And I'm wondering if Nico Rosberg winning the last two, and Adam, you and I have touched on this off the air, and Frank, this is the meat and potatoes that I've been waiting to get to, honestly. Nico Rosberg's home track is Monaco. He makes sure that he defends his helm. That kid is not going to get pushed around in his hometown by Lewis Hamilton. I mean, he can sit here and get shoved around and get pissed off and, you know, essentially you could almost see it on the podium where he just wants to physically just harm or assault Lewis Hamilton. I mean, just because of how things have kind of gone. I don't see him getting pushed.
Yeah, he wants to kick him into something. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think that you're going to see Lewis Hamilton push him around at Monaco, and I don't think Nico Rosberg is going to settle for being a number two driver at his home track. That said, Monaco is incredibly important to Ferrari. Not just from a standpoint, Kimi Raikkonen was fast last year until Max Chilton took him out. Could have very easily potentially put in a podium finish, probably third, until the lap Max Chilton took care of that. And now Max Chilton is longer in Formula One and in IndyCar Junior level series. Let's put that in perspective, folks. I think that if Ferrari can handle Mercedes there and potentially, I'll say steal a win because their car is not very favorable to that track, but it is difficult to pass. It's a very tight, windy track. They could really pull some momentum going into places like Canada, going, you know, Gilles Villeneuve is a fast track, you know, Spa's a fast track, Monza. I really think that there's a chance here, especially when you look at the European rounds. There's a month off pretty much before Spa. There's a lot of updates that come with that, and I'm kind of ranting on here for a little bit more than I'd like to, but ultimately, I think they could take the fight to Lewis Hamilton. I think Ferrari is going to take a fight in this manufacturer's battle to Mercedes.
I hope so. You know, and since you mentioned Monaco, I just want to bring up my favorite Monaco quote, and it comes from a three-time World Driver Champion Nelson Piquet, who says, "Racing in Monaco is like riding your bicycle in your living room." and Nico's been so good there, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah, Nico's not going to lay down a Hamilton there. And maybe that's what Nico needs to turn his season around. I just often wonder if Nico would be better off to get out of there and be a team leader somewhere else. But, you know, maybe he'll turn it around. And you know, he's Hamilton's about 33 points up right now.
Something like that, yeah.
But it's early in the season, but it's a pretty big lead because what do you get for a win at Formula One these days? Is it 10 points?
25 points for a win. 25
so
points.
He's got more than a win's worth of points for the lead, but I do think he's catchable, but it's going to have to be like you were saying, Frank. Somebody's going to have to make a stand, and the most likely person to do that is Nico. And even if Nico's not the guy that's going to challenge him, he's the most likely to steal points. But Nico's really smart. He's one of the most intelligent drivers on the grid, and he knows his history. If he can win in Monaco for a third year in a row, he will be the first driver to have won more than two races in a row in Monaco since Senna. And other than Senna, the only other driver to pull that off is Mr. Monaco himself, Graham Hill.
Graham Hill.
Would be a huge coup for Nico to be up there in the record books with names like Graham Hill and Ayrton Senna. So he needs to make that stand. I hope he makes it, and it lets Ferrari catch up for an exciting championship.
I tell you this, if things continue to go the way that they're going, Nico is going to be one of the greatest Formula One racers to not ever win a title. And to me, I mean, Adam, you and I talked off the air about this, about how, honestly, in my opinion, Mercedes has screwed Nico Rosberg so many different ways. I mean, you don't have a guy...
I'll agree.
I mean, you don't have a guy that's number two to Michael Schumacher as a German, on a German manufactured team, and has the resources there, knows the personnel, and is all about the team, not hashtag team LH, and is essentially doing everything that's asked of him. You know, you bring in a world champion, and I understand he's a world champion. He's a world champion by luck, and Timo Glock pretty much giving away a position. I really feel like they should have just let him battle it out more. I mean, when you look at Nico, the talent's there. I really feel like he's handicapped by the Niki Lauda and the Toto Wolff. And you know what? Who's to say that if Kimi Raikkonen doesn't take this contract extension by Ferrari that, I mean, could you imagine if Nico gets a chance to go over there and you've got an all-German lineup? I mean, Nico seems to be getting along very well, more so with Ferrari and with Sebastian Vettel and Kimi Raikkonen more than he does even his own teammate. So just something, we'll see how it evolves. I personally want to see Kimi Raikkonen in that Ferrari for as long as humanly possible. But Kimi is everything that's awesome in Formula One and everything that's right because he brings something so different and less political, and it's refreshing. And, you know, when you can have guys like that, they need to be in the sport for a long time. Otherwise, it's just kind of a lull.
I agree, and if Nico Rosberg ends up as the next Stirling Moss, that won't be the worst thing in the world.
Definitely not.
Well,
he'll end up as the next Stirling Moss, but hopefully he won't be the next David Coulthard or Rubens Barrichello.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to be asking questions to drivers on podiums anymore, or anytime soon. But all I can think of now is David Coulthard at Abu Dhabi when Kimi won.
Oh, boy.
I'm not going to rephrase that because that's just something that shouldn't be said on the air.
Talk about on the air. You better move on to NASCAR.
You know, that's exactly where I was going with this, Adam. You know, we had a wet and wacky weekend in Bristol. I tell you what's so amazing to me is heading into this weekend, we had three guys who had finished in the top 10 in every single race this year. Kevin Harvick, who is on an absolutely ridiculous hot streak. Joey Logano and the well unknown that you would never have guessed unless you were an avid NASCAR fan of his, Martin Truex Jr. for the single car outfit Furniture Row Racing, had compiled top 10 finishes in every race leading into this weekend. And opening first few laps, Brad Keselowski loses it. Joey Logano gets collected in it. There goes his hopes. Martin Truex Jr. gets collected in something later in the race. There goes his hopes. Jimmy Johnson decides to get into Jeb Burton for being impatient. I'm guessing it was around lap 250. I'm guessing here. I was watching it, but the lap number escapes me here. All I can tell you is after like the third time they started it after rain. But gets impatient with Jeb Burton, turns Jeb Burton. Kevin Harvick's leading the race. And essentially, whether it was a blind spot from the A post or what have you, just backs it up into Jeb and damages the right front, and there goes his. So finally now, as we've hit what is, I believe, the ninth round on the season, we've officially knocked off any driver running a streak of top 10 finishes. So going into Richmond this upcoming weekend, there are no more streaks. They are over. That being said, Matt Kenseth ended up winning a race that a lot of people, for whatever reason, are calling controversial because NASCAR decided to pretty much run a bunch of caution laps, like 11 under the rain at the end, and then run a green-white checker at the end, and it caused guys like Austin Dillon, who are running third, to run out of fuel. Now, you're running caution laps, you're going to save fuel right there, but at the same time, it's Bristol. Good luck saving fuel. It's too short of a track to really do that. I applaud NASCAR for trying to get in every lap because there were fans that pretty much waited out the monsoon to watch the end of that thing. And the race ended at like 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. Honestly, it was pretty cool to see a spring race under the lights at Bristol. That's something I had never seen. But, you know, Frank, what do you take away from this Kenseth win? It was his first win in over a year. It's 51 starts since he won. We're seeing Gibbs really pick up their short track program with Hamlin winning at Martinsville, with Kenseth winning here. You know, and on the side note bit, Eric Jones, the up-and-coming hot shoe for Joe Gibbs Racing that raced trucks, won the Xfinity race last week at Texas, ended up subbing in for Denny Hamlin after the first rain delay because Denny Hamlin had neck spasms. You know, so What do you take away from this whole weekend, the Gibbs organization as a whole? Obviously, their short track program is back. Are they back? And, you know, what do you know or what do you think about this up-and-coming hot shoe, Eric Jones?
I don't know much about Eric Jones, but I will tell you that Matt Kenseth, I used to watch Matt Kenseth race at a local track in Kokona, Wisconsin, when I lived there. And this is 1995. And back then I thought that kid was something special. Well, you know, now he's you know, he's big time in NASCAR, and he's like, you know, my friend Steve calls him the silent assassin. He just come out of nowhere to win the race. A great race for Matt sticking in there. And as far as adding the extra laps, I actually applaud NASCAR for trying to get that whole thing in. I know there were not a ton of fans left in the stands. The time of the race was, I think, 9 hours and 44 minutes, which theoretically gives you an average speed of 26.5 miles an hour. Not really impressive, but I might applaud NASCAR for not just washing it out. You got to love the tracks for the lights where they can do that. You know, my takeaways from Bristol. Yeah, Matt Kenseth, now he's in the chase. And this guy, he can win anywhere. Kenseth is just, he's very quiet. This isn't Kenseth the guy that they made the chase for, right? Kenseth won the championship with one race win.
That's right, back in 2003.
Years ago, and they said, well, we need to have something better than this because we don't like this. But again, you know, gaining points and being there. And the Gibbs organization is, you know, been a tough and stout organization, as you know, back to the Dale Jarrett years. Now, Denny Hamlin, different story. I mean, what's up with the neck spasms? Has Denny Hamlin brought more doctor's notes to work than anybody you know?
Man.
Right? I mean, you know, I mean, what's up with this guy, right? It's always something with Denny Hamlin. Always, I got something in my eye. I got my neck hurts today, so I just gotta wonder about that with Denny. Although Denny pulled off a great win at Martinsville early this year, I remember guys like Dale Earnhardt driving with a broken collarbone, or Jim Herdebees having his hands burned. And said, "Oh yeah, just to make them fit a steering wheel, and I'll be like that the rest of my life." I was like, "God, you know, why is Hamlin I don't know the words I'm looking for, but it just really, my neck hurts, I can't run." So Denny, I love you, man, but tough it up. But again, I applaud NASCAR getting the entire race distance in, plus 11 more laps, to make sure that the tribute to Steve Burns finished under green, and Steve lived two more days. So, yeah, I enjoyed Bristol a ton. I always do.
I'll touch a little bit on the Gibbs factor. I mean, obviously, anybody was going to get hurt if they take the hit that Kyle Busch took. That being said, if you're going to become an injury-prone driver being under the Gibbs banner, sign me up for Front Row Motorsports. I mean, I'm just telling you, I would much rather go and finish 18th to 34th before I'm going to continue to be consistently hurt. But there does seem to be a trend there with Denny where, you know, I remember a few years back, he tore I believe it was his ACL or whatnot playing basketball. Obviously, everybody knows about the fractured back after the Logano wreck at California at Auto Club, and then a year later at the same track, for whatever reason, something was messed with his eye. I don't know if it was like metal in his eye or what have you. That thought escapes me. But and then obviously now with neck spasms, they're lucky they got a guy like Eric Jones in the bandwagon seat there. I mean, that kid looks like he is cut out for superstardom. I mean, I put Eric Jones in the wheelhouse of Chase Elliott, Ryan Blaney, and him. I really feel like that core group of three are the next generation of superstars that are really going to push NASCAR into the forefront. They already are in the forefront, but just push them that much further out. That being said, Frank, I've listened to your show. For the listeners that we have that don't know, Frank Santoroski here also gets a chance to get on Drafting the Circuits. They have their own radio show podcast, and you've got a guy over there. I believe his name is Steve Abel is the one that called this. I was listening to the show last night, and he had talked about how maybe we see Eric Jones. Not that these two organizations are close anymore. There's a lot of fuss with the Toyota program as far as who should have been number one, and things have kind of topsy-turvied every which way. But maybe we see Joe Gibbs and Michael Waltrip Racing make a deal to put Eric Jones in maybe a Michael Waltrip Racing ride to get this kid some seat time, because I personally don't necessarily agree with that assessment. I think we're going to see a guy like David Ragan get pushed out, because unless he wins in the next few weeks, what do they have to lose? I mean, obviously, if David Ragan wins, you question or not whether or not you want to put Kyle Busch in that car at the end of the year. Yeah, and ultimately you get.
Yeah, I'd like to see Eric Jones in a car. And I'm gonna just for the record, it wasn't Steve Abel's our Formula One guy. It was he was probably Gray Warren or Ronnie Craig Payne, our two NASCAR guys who called that. But I didn't see a lot of the race, but because it was only on for like all day and all night. but you got to get these talented kids in cars, and you know, if Denny keeps bringing the doctor's notes, so you know, maybe that'll help Eric Jones out. But for him to hop in there on short notice, fantastic work out of this young kid.
In a Michael Waltrip car? Yeah, why not? Sure. Love to see it.
Here's the there's two more points I want to throw, Frank, your way. And that's and Adam, I want you to chime in on this as well. We've changed the culture in NASCAR with the fact that you can miss a race or miss two races or three races and still qualify for the chase if you win a race. Given how we've seen Darrell Waltrip race with a broken leg, we've seen, like you touched on, Dale Earnhardt with a broken collarbone, there's been guys that have really pushed through injuries in the old days, and we are really far away from the old school mentality here. NASCAR is really progressing into a modern movement. That being said, do you feel like that hurts the sport, or do you really like where they've come from, where you can be hurt and out of maybe respect or safety for not only that driver but other drivers on track, you allow them to miss a race? I think that streaks like Ricky Rudd's are going to be hard-pressed to be broken given the culture that they're allowing in NASCAR now.
Yeah, it is a real culture shift, because I'm glad you brought this back up. When y'all start talking about Denny and how he's in Mr. Race here and Mr. Race here, there's always some kind of medical thing. So many old examples of old racers driving when, you know, maybe they even shouldn't have, but they did back in the day when they had injuries or issues. And it's sad because that's how heroes are born, but I think from a modern safety standpoint, maybe it's a good thing. The biggest example to me is Carroll Shelby. When he was driving at Le Mans in 1959 for Aston Martin, he was popping nitroglycerin pills for angina. He had a heart condition. He's taking his medicine in the car, driving, you know, through the night, down the Mulsanne Strait, and he won. He and Rory Salvadori won. So, you know, and there are more recent examples. I remember a few years ago, I can't remember which race it was, there was a bad fuel stop in Formula One, and Kimi Raikkonen got fuel in his eyes. And he came on the radio, and he said, it's burning like hell. They said, well, do you want to retire? Do you want to come in? Do you want to do anything? He said, no, I'll finish. I got this. So, you know, I don't know what's worse, metal in your eye or fuel in your eye, but some people keep going, some people don't. But it's cool that they can still make the chase by getting that win. I think that's how we'll see Denny Hamlin get in season after season. But it's a more, I guess, conscientious way to go racing. And so it's pretty cool that NASCAR is doing it. I applaud it. I'll miss the old days. But as far as a safety standpoint, and you can never go too far in the name of safety, really, I'll say I'm not 100% all right, let's do it. But it's a good idea. Frank?
Hey, you know, I'm torn with this, because at the one time, you want to keep your guys safe. You want to keep them okay. At the same time, we want heroes that are larger than life. You know, we want guys to battle through this stuff and just to be tough as nails. You know, we want our drivers to be John Wayne. I remember, you guys remember the 1991 Indy 500, where
yep.
Rick Mears and Michael Andretti were battling. You know, Mears has serious foot injuries, and his feet were hurting so bad towards the end of the race that he crossed his feet in the car and accelerated with his other foot to keep that foot on the accelerator to win that race. And just stories like that are what the racing lore is made out of.
That's awesome.
But at the same time, you don't want these guys to drive hurt. You want them to heal well, to live a long life after they've done racing and raise their families and tell the story. So I'm really torn with it. But again, you know, for me, I just want my racing heroes to be larger than life. So that's where I'm at with that. I really don't have a good answer one way or the other. But yeah, there you go.
I look at this situation. I think NASCAR, the reason why, to Adam's point, a guy like Kimi Raikkonen is going to keep fighting is because F1 doesn't have a chase format. They didn't set themselves up for that. NASCAR very much has, and they've really allowed this to permeate through the garage and to the drivers, and it's given a lot of leeway. But at the same time, like Frank was touching on, you lose the lore. And I'll tell you firsthand, the first race that I ever watched that drew me to racing was the 1996 Indianapolis 500 when Buddy Lazier won. And Buddy Lazier ended up winning that race with a broken back. And I immediately was hooked and inspired by the fact that this guy ended up pretty much damn near paralyzed. And he couldn't even get out of the car comfortably. I mean, it was just, he got out and just sat. He didn't stand up, grab the milk, get the wreath popped around his body and celebrate like we're accustomed to seeing in Indy Victory Lane. This was a guy that just got out, sat on the side pod and kicked it with his teammates or his team, his pit crew. And that right there immediately hooked me. And for everything that Frank said and Adam said, I mean, fighting through things, the adversity, the willpower, that is what is, it's so strong. It draws you to racing. I mean, that's Tiki Barber not fumbling while he's still got a cast on his arm as a New York Giant several years ago and just pushing through when they're trying to make a Super Bowl run. Or, you know, it's just, are those days gone for NASCAR? Probably. But are they gone for IndyCar? Are they gone for the likes of F1? Unless they change their format, I don't think so. And I think it gives an opportunity to see some phenomenal runs. And we'll just see what happens from there.
You say they're gone, and you have guys like Denny that'll have something that'll err on the side of caution and quit. But then you've got other guys. I can see Tony Stewart having a broken toe and saying, hell, I'm still going to race. So I do think we'll still have those moments. I think we won't if NASCAR steps in and says, if you have, you know, something more severe than such and such, or they make it really specific, they'll cut that out. But I think you'll still see some guys go out there and race with injuries and things holding them back.
Probably bad you mentioned Tony Stewart since he broke his leg a couple years ago and didn't race part of the season.
Well, that's a broken leg. That's different. But yeah, I'm saying if he had a cast on his wrist, I could still see him trying.
Moving on from that, Frank, this Bristol is way different than the Bristol you grew up watching. This Bristol has got some attitude to it towards the top lane. You know, they added in the safer barriers, thank goodness, all the way around the track, and the racing group kind of moved. We saw three wide racing with Matt Kenseth threading the needle in this race. What do you take away from this new Bristol? Are you a big fan of this? Is it better than the old Bristol where we traditionally saw the low line bump and run, Gordon on Wallace, Earnhardt on Labonte? Is this a step up from that?
I think it is. Yeah. The thing that saddens me is that, you know, as long as I live here in Kentucky and I'm not that far from Bristol, and for years, I was told, you can't get a Bristol ticket. You know, you got to get in a wait list. Now you can buy a Bristol ticket at the box office. That's a comment on the economic climate as well as the state of racing. But, you know, Bristol, the first Bristol race I saw had two little grandstands, you know, front and back straight. And I think Ernie Irvin won that one that I watched. And now Bristol looks like a freaking football stadium. You know, they put 100. They have 180,000 seats there.
Yeah, it's
crazy. But now they can't fill it. So I think the racing is better, but the fans aren't coming out like they used to in droves. So, you know, it's on the economy as much as it is on the racing, but I thought this race was pretty darn exciting. I've always liked Bristol. Bristol's, you know, you can write so many great stories about Bristol races in the past and Bristol races in the present. So it's one of NASCAR's iconic, fabulous tracks that will be there for years to come, and I hope that the fans come back and fill those 180,000 seats as the economy improves.
Yeah, I don't think they like to clamor that they're the world's fastest half mile, and they're the most well-renowned half mile. I'll give them that, but you know, for all the short track lovers that are listening in, I've got to give the world's fastest half mile to Winchester. Go look at the speeds and tell me who's faster. But you know, that track, Thunder Valley, it's built itself up into what is iconically and rightfully so. They've marketed it themselves. Getting tongue-tied there, folks. Excuse me. Is, you know, the Roman Colosseum, they're pretty much taking that embodiment by telling the entire world that they're the last great Colosseum. And for any other term, they are. I mean, they've really built that thing up, like Frank just touched on. 180,000 that they can seat in there. And the thing is just packed to the gills as far as just seats and press boxes, and it's just wrapped around. And it is just all around. It looks like the Colosseum. I mean, it's just, I hate the fact that the economics have come to the fact that you're not on a wait list. I kind of like the fact you're not on a wait list, because as a kid growing up, I always wanted to go to Bristol, and I still do. But, you know, at the same time, we're journalists in this industry, and the last thing you want to see is an industry struggle. And when you've got a sanctioning body that is the number one motorsport sanctioning body in North America, probably number two in the world behind the FIA, the last thing you want to hear is that they can't put asses in the seats. And they still do, don't get me wrong. They still fill the stadium quite a bit, but it's not sold out like it once was. And like Frank touched on, I mean, I think at one point growing up, I heard that they were 3 years in advance on the wait list, or some ridiculous, ungodly number. But
used to be impossible to get a Bristol ticket unless you bought it from a scalper.
Right. It's almost like who you know. So, but yeah, we'll see. The racing in any series right now, in F1, in IndyCar, in NASCAR, is as good as it's ever been. And I know that just, you know, folks, I know the economics and the tough times are there. If you ever get a chance to go out to one of these tracks to see any of these three series, and obviously F1's going to be a harder ticket, but if you get a chance, it's just bang for the buck. Outside of short track racing, if you get a chance to do that, definitely go treat yourself to that. But it's just bang for the buck. Phenomenal. Adam, I know you had something you want to add on the NASCAR front.
Yeah, I want to pat NASCAR on the back. If you compare and contrast this Bristol race with IndyCar at NOLA, this was, you know, like a 10-hour race, as Frank was saying, 511 laps. But they ran the extra laps because they wanted to give the fans a good finish. There's a little bit of controversy, people running out of fuel, but discounting that, they gave the fans something to go away with happy. It was a great victory, great for Kenseth to break his wind drought. If you contrast that to IndyCar at NOLA, cutting it short, making it a timed race, the absolute disaster that was, I want to applaud NASCAR for sticking in there. The fans stuck with them. They stuck with us. They stuck with the media. They stuck with the fans. And they gave off a great race. So thank you to NASCAR for that. It made Bristol way better than it would have been. I hope IndyCar can take a note out of that playbook and do the same for all of us in the future.
That being said, I would like to do, like, maybe away with the debris cautions, per se. But I didn't see too many at Bristol. Ironically, of all places you don't see a debris caution, it's Bristol. And the one place you would expect to see a debris caution is Bristol. So
that's a good point.
For the life of me, I don't even know.
Well, Bristol, the banks are so high, the debris just rolls down to the, you know, to the center of the track.
Yeah, very true. Very true. I just wonder what could have been with the Long Beach finish if they would have had maybe a caution with 10 laps to go or something, and you have like a 10-lap shootout. Man, I think that would have been really interesting to see how that staged up. But that being said, I want to thank Josh Farmer and Christopher DeHardy for being on the show. If you get a chance to check out their stuff, it's always a blast to have them on the show. Frank, I'll start with you. Yeah, we're going to make our rounds here for some final thoughts. We got just a handful of minutes left here on the show, and we'll kick it off with you. So you have the floor, sir.
Well, I will just tell you, I am so pleased that the IndyCar got a great race in at Long Beach. You know, it wasn't a heavy on passing or anything like that, but a lot of green flag laps, and the way the season started off, it looked ugly. But now we're in a better place. Barber's a great track for the series. It's a great track for the all those guys up there at the top of the running there. I want to see Honda do a little better. You know, maybe, you know, Ryan Hunter Reyes won at the Barber the last 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. Let's get the season going. I'm just looking forward to Barber. Beautiful facility, and I want to get the scars of NOLA and St. Pete behind us as we finish up Barber and go into the month of May, where I think all of us are going to be there at the race.
Yep, that's the plan anyway.
I'll give my final thoughts. I am really happy IndyCar did have a clean race, a pretty good race. You know, it's not the most exciting when Dixon wins, but I was excited to see a lack of cautions, a lack of winglets and flick-ups and things breaking and shattering everywhere, a lack of people going off track and crashing, and I think having the lack of rain. So I think that was a real upswing. I was thrilled for F1 to have another exciting race. I think they will again. F1 and Indy are both going to some of their better tracks next. And the month of May is coming up where hopefully we will all be up in Indianapolis. And on the NASCAR front, you know, Gibbs won. But if you look right behind him, it's Johnson and Gordon, so Hendrick. And even though none of the guys who have been in the top 10 for all these races in a row with these great streaks, Kevin Harvick did lead 184 laps of that race before getting taken out by a crash. Had nothing really to do with him. So it's still going in a way, and I expect Harvick to bounce back, and I'm excited to see where that leads as well. Joey?
Well, usually I'm on the show, and apparently I'm really well known for my ranting and stuff, and you know, for the people that have listened in, they know that I'm not really that gentle towards drivers. If I've got an issue, I usually voice it pretty loudly and
oh boy,
start a ruckus. That being said, this week was the week that I ate crow, and I will humbly accept eating crow. I give Ricky Stenhouse so much crap for being outran by his girlfriend. It's unbelievable. And you know, the kid ended up showing out. I think he finished fourth in the race. I'm not looking at
that. Yeah, he was fourth.
And then Sebastian Saavedra last year, I gave so much hell, and he ended up. And you know what? I'll say this. Good for Saavedra, because there's a reason I give these drivers hell. If I didn't believe in them, I wouldn't talk about them. I mean, I'm not going to – I'll tell you right now, I don't believe in Francesco Tricconi. But
believe in Chilton?
Don't watch. Draconi will finish on podium this week. I mean, if James Jakes can do it. But you mean that kid from One Direction? There's the line for you.
Yeah, yeah, that's the guy.
But, you know, I humbly eat crow on the behalf of all my ranting and say good job to Ricky Stenhouse. I tip my cap to you. I tip my cap to Sebastian Saavedra. I wish that if we could get Saavedra in a decent ride, it makes me wonder if KB Racing was actually that bad and the equipment he was in, because he got good equipment and he had a chance to show it, and the kid popped the top 10 first time out. So with a new team, a new engineer, a new everything. So I think that maybe if he gets one or two more chances, and he will later this year, as we heard from Farmer, that good things are on the horizon for him. And how about the fact that for all of the things that have been difficult for IndyCar of putting asses in the seats, they packed out that place at Long Beach 181,000 strong.
Amen.
Phenomenal phenomenal, phenomenal. Shout out to them because I, man, I tell you what, we all on this show are very critical because we want to see IndyCar do so well. And, you know, it's just, it's finally nice to see. It's refreshing to see. Very, very happy on that front. And I really hope that we get to see them pack out venues outside of the Indy 500 just as well as they packed out Long Beach, because IndyCar is, and I'll tell you right now for anybody that's listening on here, IndyCar is the best competition top to bottom that you will see. I mean, they put out so many crazy finishes, so many great winners last year. From top to bottom, the field is about as evenly matched as you could ask for. If you get a chance to go an IndyCar race, folks, go do it. You know, there's an IndyCar plug. You're welcome, IndyCar. But, and then I guess a couple more shout outs to give, because I'm not done here. I'll go on my little banter. Danica Patrick, congratulations to you, girl, breaking Janet Guthrie, the tie that you had with Janet Guthrie on most top 10 finishes. Phenomenal on your part. And Justin Allgaier, the 8th Scott Motorsport Wonder, who I had been watching for the early part of the season, finished 12th and 12th and 16th and 11th. And 10 to go, was running in the top 10 so many times. You finally brought it home. I believe you finished 8th. Awesome run for you, man. It was great to see a finish for you and a small-time team like that. I know we recognize a lot of teams like Truex, and we look at how David Ragan goes from front row to Gibbs. But Allgaier was a guy that was with Penske, didn't get the call-up to go to the top level. Is as talented as a racer that I see on that field that isn't in the top ride next to Landon Castle and Alex Bowman. And it was just absolutely great to see. So, that being said, we want to thank everybody for listening in tonight. Frank, on behalf of... I'm getting tongue-tied a lot tonight, guys. Josh Farmer, Krista Hardy, once again, thank them for joining along. Frank Santoroski, Drafting the Circuits. If you get a chance, go to wabazoo.draftingthecircuits.com. Check out their stuff. Check out their podcast. It's phenomenal. Check out some of Frank's writing. It's absolutely top to bottom, some of the best stuff you'll ever read. Adam Tate of Tribute Racing. I'm Joey Barnes, also of Tribute Racing. Burn Strong. Thoughts are with him and his family, Steve Burns. And as well as Jules Bianchi, Forza Jules, Michael Schumacher, keep fighting Michael, and Michael Johnson from Pro Mazda, getting healthy. We hope to see you at a track soon. So with that being said, we want to thank y'all for listening in, and y'all have a good night. Thank you for joining us on this latest edition of In the Gravel Trap.